You knew you were in trouble?
Wait.
Isn't that universal? Oh my gosh, the mics are on.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day. This is the Subcommittee on Public Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5504, the Department of Corrections budget. Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot to go through today. There are three divisions: Health Services, Operations, and Offender Management and Rehabilitation. Also, responses to almost all of the questions that were raised yesterday will be posted soon, sometime during the next hour and a half, and they will be posted on the March 16th date. So with that, we're ready for Mr. Gower.
Come on up.
Good morning, good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters. I'm director of the Department of Corrections. And as a woman whose mother was 100% Irish, I too will wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day and let you know that I am flying my colors. And I'm pleased to let you know that I brought an Irishman here to speak to you today.
Excellent.
About prison operations. And while he does not sit before you with an Irish brogue, he does have a Bostonian accent, so I hope you can understand what he has to say.
I'll just have him repeat often.
So I do have the pleasure of introducing Assistant Director Mike Gower. We are so privileged to have him as part of our agency and in the position that he's in. He sits before you with more than 30 years of service in public safety, 10 years in Cape Cod, Massachusetts as an officer, came to Oregon and worked for the Oregon State Police as a trooper for 10 years, and now has been with the Oregon Department of Corrections after we stole him from the state police for nearly 12 years now, having sat as superintendent twice over three institutions, and now has been the assistant director of operations since 2008. So before I turn it over to him, the only thing that I will point out is I will reiterate what was just said, which is we have a lot of information to get through today. And so our hope is that we get through the presentation from Mr. Gower, Mr. Robbins, and at least partway through Ms. Stewart's in order to remain on time and get to public testimony on Thursday. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Mr. Gower.
Thank you, Director. Good morning, co-chairs Williamson and Shields and committee members. For the record, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'd first like to start out and thank the wonderful folks that I have the ability to work with that has given me the privilege to be in front of you today. You're going to hear about 14 institutions that we operate here in the state of Oregon, and I'm very proud of the fact of the leadership that we have with our 10 superintendents, our administrators, all our managers, our lieutenants, our captains that run the show when we're not there. But I'd submit to you, back in 1980, I'm going to go on a little hockey trivia here, when the United States beat Russia for the gold, didn't win the gold medal with them, but when they beat Russia in 1980, on their chest had the three C's and the P's. And that's what I would submit to you in reference to our relationship with our two labor organizations, AFSCME and the association, that we communicate, the three C's, we communicate, we collaborate, we compromise, and that helps us build our partnership with both of those organizations that makes us successful and the reason why we're here today. The Operations Division is responsible for the overall security, housing, and daily operations of our Oregon incarcerated adult inmates. That's both male and female. We recognize that these offenders are sent to us as punishment, not for punishment. We have the responsibility to hold them accountable for their actions, and we believe our role is to prevent future victimization. Here you're going to see our organizational chart. For the Operations Division, we have four administrative units. We have the prisons as the institutions, transport, central services, and health services. I will tell you today that I'm going to talk about the three units. I have the health care administrator, Mr. Steve Robbins, in the corner that is going to be speaking to us, or speaking to you, I should say, in respect to our health services, which will include the medical, mental health, and our pharmacies. The Operations Division has a small central administrative team that is responsible for management oversight of our policies, procedures, and rules, which is guided by four contracts, labor contracts, like I said earlier, involving AOCE and AFSCME. We have the oversight of managing our staff scheduling, oversight of our food services, also responding to our stakeholders, including inmate families, community organizations, legislators, and other government entities. Each of our institutions also have a small administrative unit that does the same function as the administrative unit here at the Dome Building, but they also coordinate and collaborate with the other 14 institutions. Next slide, please. Here you'll see up in the right-hand corner that the Operations Division accounts for 46% of the general fund from our budget, and this helps us run our day-to-day operations to include feeding, clothing, providing the safety and personal needs of more than 14,500 of our inmate population, men and female. Our FTE, we have approximately 3,200 employees in the Operations Division that accounts for 72% of our workforce. The facility ranges from having 38 staff at South Fork in the Tillamook Forest to our largest unit, which is out in Ontario, that has about 740 employees at Snake River. I'd like to also say a majority of our Operations Division, about 78, almost 79% of our employees actually work in the security series. That's about 2,500 employees. Our major drivers, budget drivers, of course, as I stated, the amount of employees we have, staff compensation is a major driver for our division. Occasional overtime is less costly than new staff. However, chronic overtime puts stress on existing staff and ends up costing us more. We also have an outdated post-relief factor. One critical point in our post-relief factor is that we have fixed post obligations. That means these posts are not optional. They need to be staffed regardless of the circumstances. As I said, the Operations Division contains about 73% of the agency's workforce, so salary benefits, including overtime, is one of our biggest budget drivers. Inmate medical costs, I'm going to allow Steve Robbins, the healthcare administrator, to address that. Hospital watches. Yesterday you saw a graph that we, right now, under 1% of our individuals, we try to take care of in-house when it comes to medical needs, but on occasions we have to bring them outside into the community. And when that does happen, besides the health care costs that we have to accrue, these men and women have to be supervised depending on their classification. If it's a minimum inmate, then classification, we're allowed to have one person supervision. If it is a higher class of inmate, then we have to have a minimum of two. If it's a trip to go out for a day trip, then sometimes it's 4 to 6 hours for supervision, but occasionally these folks have to stay overnight, whether it's in a hospital or care unit, and then we have to do 24 hours, 7 day a week coverage as long as they're there. Food.
Senator Winters.
Oh, Madam
Lovely
Chair.
Lovely green outfit you have on.
Thank you. Top of the morning to you too, or it's afternoon. We did we had a work group on the subject of medical costs, and it might be that you might want to share for those individuals who haven't followed and tracked that particular work activity, the report that came from that work group with the members of this panel.
I'll take this.
Okay.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we certainly will do that. Following Mr. Gower's presentation, Mr. Robbins is going to come forward.
Oh, he's going to come forward and go
into more depth for you all.
You're just always ahead of me.
We read your mind, Senator. Thank you.
Co-chairs, committee members. Food, clothing, and personal supplies. Weather conditions and market conditions always create have an effect on commodities like food. This past year, things that are out of our control, ground beef, for example, went up about 33%. Produce went up about 30% over the last year and a half. These type of increases we don't have control over. I'd be proud to say that with our food costs to include food and supplies up till December 14th was $2.64. Facility maintenance and costs. I'd like to focus a moment on the facility costs. There's two different dynamics with the DOC. We have older facility like OSP down the street that has aging plumbing, electrical, heating, and cooling systems. In our newer facilities, or we say modern facilities, contain integrated technology. And I'd like to point out that some of the institutions that we say are newer, like at Snake River, that's 20 years old now. So as we talk about OSP being built in the 1800s, our newer facilities are actually aging as well.
Fuels and up to code on OSP?
Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Wills, I didn't catch that.
Up to code.
Up to code.
Yeah, up to code.
Yeah, Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Wynn, it is up to code. That's why we're able to maintain it still at this point.
Yeah.
We're happy to say we have great folks over there. Fuels and utilities, we've been able to manage our utility costs within budget due to the combination of mild winters and active pursuit of efficiencies. However, during this current biennium, DOC took a reduction in the utilities budget, which has created a challenge for us in this category. In addition to the budget levels, we're receiving an end-of-market fluctuation in both fuels and utility costs, but presently right now some of the the fuel costs have helped us since they've gone down in reference to our transportation of our inmates. Disturbances, as the director mentioned in her opening statement, we have some of the safe and secure prisons in the nation. However, disturbances do occur. We do follow leading indicators to monitor the climate in the institutions and try to take steps proactively to diffuse situations before they become disruptive. But sometimes unexpected things do happen. We have inmate deaths, or we have a conflict between rival groups. This can put a significant time and resource in effect for us in reference to bringing back the institutions back to order. Here we have the locations. You can see we pretty much cover the four corners of the state. Up in the left-hand corner, we have South Fork, as I pointed out, our smallest unit, going all the way over to Snake River over in Ontario, which is our largest unit with over 3,000 inmates. Our oldest is OSP, built in the late 1800s. And our newest facility, which is built in Madras, we opened that in 2007, the minimum side only. The medium still sits vacant, and we did deactivate OSPM in 2010. That's the smaller prison that's outside the walls of the Oregon State Penitentiary. This next chart shows you the institution, what it was originally built for. The E beds stand for the emergency beds that we have put online with the assistance and collaboration of our labor groups between AOCE and AFSCME. We've been able to add these beds without additional staffing. As you can see, other than Shutter Creek down in Coos Bay and South Fork, we have limitations in reference to water issues and sewer issues. All our other institutions have had built more capacity. Adults in our custody are placed in housing situations to minimize friction and separated within institutions or moved to other facilities when conflicts do occur. Movement is managed throughout the facility to allow necessary degree of control over offender population. As Director Peters mentioned, the new PREA standards were adopted in 2012, and part of those standards, one-third of those prisons have to be audited. And we're happy to state, as she did, in 2004 we had three institutions that passed, and then, in 2013 we had three, and then this past year, in 2014, we had four. So seven, almost half of our institutions have passed. The Operations Division is taking the lead on breakthrough initiatives to optimizing use of special housing beds. A principal focus of this will be long-term effectiveness of placement in special housing as inmate management tool. A couple of weeks ago, we were selected to participate in the Safe Alternative to Segregation Project with the Vera Institute and DOJ. We'll receive a two-year technical assistance focusing on analyzing the use of segregated housing and developing recommendations for safe reduction, as well as initial assistance with implementation of these recommendations. We have already started that with our optimizing use of housing beds, where we are put a group together to look at best practices across the nation what other DOCs are doing to minimize the isolation in special housing beds. Here is a next slide, please.
The next here is a perfect example. Out at Snake River, we call this the Blue Room. It's a groundbreaking nature imagery research project. In 2013, Snake River started working with a university professor who was exploring ways that nature positively impact individuals. What we have here in our RMU, this is an indoor rec area, and we have video capability of 13 different imageries with audio. So either when the inmates we see decompressing, or they ask to have some time out, they pick which one of the visuals they would like to visit or be with. They go in there and they have some quiet time. Myself and Deputy Brokamp were just out there a couple of weeks ago and witnessed this, and had engaged staff, and even the staff are recognized that when they see one of the inmates decompress, they pull them in there and they can see the calming effect that this new concept has. I'd like to state too, this was named as one of Time Magazine's 25th best innovations for 2014. We're looking at expanding this at other institutions. It's a great concept. Each day, we prepare 43,000 meals. They're planned, prepared, and served by DOC staff with the assistance of inmates. That's over 30 million meals in a biennium, 30 million meals. All our menus are certified by a registered dietitian, are consistent from institution, and can be modified to accommodate medical or religious needs. We have Passover coming up. The Passover meals cost about $20 each. As a reference for religious meals, if someone is on a kosher diet, it's $10. I think this year we have about 135 plus individuals that are participating in Passover. That's going to cost $26,000. Our present cost for an average daily meal is about $2.48. So you can see the difference if someone has a religious need at $10 and we're serving at $2.48. Here's a perfect example of efficiencies coming together. We have two facilities, Coffee Creek and Two Rivers, that were built and did not have a dining hall. So at Coffee Creek, each day we had to serve up 1,800 trays, and at Two Rivers, 1,900 trays. All the meals that were prepared, all the pieces of the meal that were prepared were put on the trays. So if an inmate didn't want to have an apple or the green beans, whatever was being served, it got served up, so we had a lot of waste. So one of the creative ideas was to bring the serving lines out to the hallways outside the living areas, and now the inmates come out and they take their meals as they would if they were in a dining hall, and we've cut back on waste and saving costs. At Two Rivers, for example, we've dropped the cost where they were at $2.76 because they had to serve all that trayed up meals. It's dropped down to $2.52.
I have a question, Mr. Gower. How have there been security incidents around serving inmates in the hallway? I know it when I was out at Two Rivers, there were two units being served lunch at the same time at the end of the court, at each end of the corridor, and the corridor doors were locked. And so I just wondered if there had been any issues around having folks who may not want to be around each other in the same hallway at the same time.
Co-Chair Williamson, that's a great question. As you notice with the doors being locked there, that was part of the precaution because there are several different types of housing units. We're always very cautious in reference to, especially at Tuvers, the movements. So that was one of the concerns. To my knowledge, it's like any prison. I'm sure there's been some incidents that have occurred, but nothing major that has brought anything to our attention. So I think so far it's been very successful in the way they've rolled it out, both at Tuvers and at Coffee Creek.
Great. That's good to hear. Thank you.
The physical plants. Each institution has its own physical plant, and it's with dedicated staff, and that is to respond to emergencies as well as timely response to non-emergency issues. They perform regular maintenance, repairs, construction work, just like they would in any type of city or work environment. These skilled trades of carpentry, electrical work, general maintenance, plumbing, painting, and ground maintenance. Staff really engage in our core mission by working with these offenders and learning the various trades. We have an apprenticeship program which inmates are gained certifications in such trades as painting, sheet metal, and electrical. Assistant Director Heidi Stewart, who's sitting behind me, will talk more about the apprenticeship programs later on, hopefully this afternoon. Institutions have embraced recycling and other sustainability programs to a great effect, reducing garbage costs, improving utility efficiencies. These accomplishments will be discussed further by Deputy Director Brokamp later this week, but this has largely been achieved by our physical plant staff. The operations division is really interconnected with all divisions, but especially when it comes to rehabilitation. The institutional counselors take the corrections plan that was developed at intake and work one-on-one with the inmates to collaborate in a multidisciplinary approach and work along with the inmate to create a path of success. They're engaging in their treatment, their programming, they're asking their questions about their work assignments, they're asking about their relationships with their families and their children. We know that the family plays an integral part of helping the inmates be successful. The institutional counselors are always working with the inmates to have them understand how their thinking and choices impact their consequences. It's all about helping them see a better way of living. We also have, you can see on here, a breakthrough initiative, correctional case management. We call it CCM. CCM Part 2 is going to be launched. We'll be embarking to review our current processes and practices to ensure that the resources are being maximized by our target inmates who are most likely to recidivate. So right now, our counselors have the caseload in reference to the inmates that have the most need. So we have individuals that will get the most attention and other individuals that won't, because the data will tell us that they won't be coming back in. Inmate transportation. We provide a statewide network of inmate transportation to include medical appointments, what I talked about, court appointments, housing and security, so that's the transportation between the institutions, programming needs. We have interstate compact transfers, so we have agreements with 30-plus other state DOCs that we transfer inmates who are either difficult to deal with or high profile. And we also do coordination of new intakes with county facilities. DOC has been participating in the Northwest Shuttle for over 30 years. We have the I-5 corridor as part of our obligation, so we drive down to Jackson, Josephine, Jackson Lane, Lynn counties, all the way down to Shasta County in California to pick up adults in custody. And it's at a great savings to the taxpayers in reference to the collaboration between the state agencies and the counties. This unit is always working ways to further efficiencies. The councils work closely with the Office of Population Management as well as health services in reference to managing the transportations. Sometimes we had folks that would be transferred from EO over to the state penitentiary, then would find out that they had a doctor's appointment the next day, so they have to be transported all the way back. So now we have much better coordination and collaboration in making it more efficient. Last year, we reduced our transfers by 1,100 trips, but we did raise our medical trips by 50. In this time period, we had 5 minor accidents. Happy to say that there were no injuries, and we haven't had any escapes.
That's good.
That's very good. This next picture illustrates our KPM, which is the Measure 17 that the director talked about. The upper left-hand corner is our adults in custody that are putting together a playground in the city of Nissa. On the top right-hand corner, you have an adult in custody male that is preparing some sort of food item. On the bottom left, we have a female that is working at our call center up at Coffee Creek. And on the bottom right, we have a male that's working in our garment factory over in Eastern Oregon in Pendleton. Inmate activities. In addition to work and programming, the department provides a wide range of inmate activities really to reduce idleness and promote pro-social, cultural, and athletic outlets for the inmate population. Inmates have the opportunity to learn about their culture and heritage, to engage in meaningful and appropriate activities such as a powwow or Kwanzaa celebrations. Inmates are encouraged to give back to the community as part of the rehabilitation process. For example, activity staff assist the inmate population in the coordination of community fundraisers and proceeds being donated to local areas for the need or community charity. We have recreation programs such as team sports. team sport leagues, keeping the inmate population engaged in constructive activities. Inmates are expected to promote good sportsmanship, conduct themselves appropriately in competitive atmosphere, and accept to work with others from diverse backgrounds and cultures. I'd like to also state, because of resources, we don't have nearly as many people we'd like to help out with these activities, so we really rely on our volunteer staff. So a lot of our volunteers help bridge the gap between the prison and community, and I'm really happy to state, as of today, we have over 1,900 volunteers assisting us throughout the state. Improving some programs and cost savings, we have a great release pilot program going on right now over at Warner Creek and Lakeview. We have a collaboration between the prison, DHS, and Community Corrections in Lake, Klamath, Jackson, and Josephine County to discuss with the adults in custody who are within 90 days of being released to those counties to hopefully make resources available to meet their needs after post-relief.
How close is that handoff? I mean, I worry about people coming. I've talked to agency head about this. You know, we find people getting handoff to a CCO with an appointment 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks later. That is not appropriate for this group or any other group, really, but especially this group. How fast do they actually get services?
Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Bates. We try to, like I said here, the 90 days, we try to engage those resources where community corrections will come in and start engaging our adults in custody in reference to preparing to get the introduction to the officer that they'll be dealing with and get information in reference to their housing, work opportunities. They start that engagement early to see how they can either assist in that process or if they're going to be making any type of assessments, you know, where they're going to be living and part of their release agreement.
You know, follow up. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to know what actually happens on the ground when that person leaves the corrections. Do they go directly to housing? Do they go directly into drug and alcohol programs within 48 hours, 72 hours? Or is it vary across the state and long distance of time sometimes? That is the norm in the state for non-correction people. Someone who needs a referral for DHS or needs a referral for medical care, if it's not a, you know, not an immediate emergency, but it's a drug problem or mental health problem, they wait weeks for care. And I just want to know, in this particular group, which is so sensitive to it, is it a long delay for them actually seeing, I don't mean they're signed up, what actually happens, they actually get the services? Do you have any idea what that lag time is?
Yeah.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Bates, fantastic question. And Your second answer is the right one. It varies by county to county. It varies on a case-by-case basis based on their risk, their need, and the resources available in the community. I think Mr. Gower is really focusing on the positive approach that we're trying to take, where there are more reach-ins happening with that PO across the system so that they know who they're reporting to. What we can say is they are required to report to their PO immediately. And so we do track that, and we are able to make that mandate. All of the other services will depend on region, resources available, and that individual's need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on this particular issue, because the good senator and I had a conversation in the hearing this morning with
AMH.
And encouraging them to have conversation with you on this whole handoff piece, particularly, recognizing that, one, we've done you've done a great job with working with the Oregon Health Authority and getting individuals, you know, signed up and enrolled over as a result of the enabling legislation. But then the next phase is that, you know, now that they are enrolled, the handoff, and to assure that particularly those who are coming out that will require further treatment or of alcohol and drug and what have you. So I just think we'd like to, you know, try to see how much we can bridge that particular gap that may be there. So just know that the two of us had that conversation this morning with the other agency and encouraging them to sit and talk with you to see how we can make certain that this is happening across the state.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters, thank you for that. We did get news that that conversation had happened, so very pleased to have it. I think this pilot really puts us on that path. I will give credit to our superintendent down in Lakeview, who is formerly with DHS and is helping us navigate that system and bridge that gap. And so I'm happy to sit down and meet with Director Kelly Seal, and we'll further the conversation.
Well, I think it's Pam, Pam Martin. But I think our concern, I know that I don't think I can speak, should speak
You're
for the
well
good
can.
Senator, but our concern is to assure that as we talk about this resource need, and as we talk about, you know, and we told them both of us are serving on both committees, that we want to make certain that, you know, we give you and help you with all the tools that you need so that reentry and the recidivism issue becomes a reality. So if that's one of the barriers and needs, we're just trying to want to make sure we help you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I? We should probably have this not taking the time of the committee's time up. AMH is starting to have wraparound services for clients, which includes housing. And instead of splitting this program between DHS, who gives you housing and SNAP and some other things, and mental health and drug and alcohol over here, we may want to look at something that says you go to one agency, that agency's going to be the CCOs and mental health and drug and alcohol, and they'll supply the DHS services that you need to. So you're not trying to deal with two different agencies, going through this whole maze of things for this highly critical group. I mean, the number I remember yesterday, it struck me, 71% of your inmates have a drug and alcohol problem. It's maybe higher than that for all you know. I mean, it's 71, might say 100, who cares? And their chance of going back into, I would guess, that lifestyle is extremely high coming out of an institution into public life again. I think the handoff has to be, you know, both hands, you know, and lock on and pull them in. I just don't know how else we can do this.
Okay.
So maybe we can talk about that some more.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, happy to have that conversation. Thank you.
Here in this slide, I'm really pleased. When I started 12 years ago, you would not have seen this. I think the females had a lot more attention when it came to the family. We've grown so much with DOC. Here you have on the upper left-hand corner at Powder River in Baker City, a dad that is in a bag race with his daughter. Up on the right-hand corner, it's a great situation going on with these two gentlemen are usually tutors for other male inmates that are getting their GEDs, and they started a program at Deer Ridge where they bring the tutors down and they encourage the families to bring their kids to visit, and if they have problems with their homework, to bring the homework so that these tutors can help the dad and the children get their homework done. Down below you have South Fork at a Halloween event where they're painting and carving pumpkins and also doing some face paintings. We also partnered up with the Wilsonville Rotary to install a new playground for children at the visiting so they can visit with their mothers at Coffee Creek. And these are just a small snapshot of all the activities of enhancement visiting and family enrichment that is going on at all our institutions. Here, any place now when you come to our institutions, if there's a spot to plant something, we're doing it. Anywhere and everywhere. So here up in the left-hand corner, you have the state penitentiary outside the grounds with their plantings at San Yam. On the right-hand, we have an earth tub compost that's helping with the plantings over at San Yam. And over at OSCI off of Highway 22, you have two gentlemen that are starting their seeds. I'd like to state that...
Quinoa program coming.
A quinoa.
How's our quinoa coming?
Coaches Williamson and Winters, I'm not quite sure on that.
Yeah, that's OIA.
But some of the, I understand that some of the ground was on your property, but.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Winters, that's correct. When we were pursuing the conversation with the Oregon Youth Authority around their ability to create veggie burgers based in quinoa, the Oregon Department of Corrections was actually going to grow the quinoa, and I'm not sure where we are in those conversations.
I think,
Senator,
we're probably waiting for the dollars from Regional Solutions.
Right.
Perhaps.
And as I understood it, that program was cost prohibitive when they penciled it all out, and so OIA didn't go forward with the veggie burgers.
Madam Co-Chair, I think you're right. You're helping my memory along. That that I believe that's where we are at, but I will double check and we will get back to you.
It's still in a regional solutions budget.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to state that we yielded approximately 275,000 pounds of produce in 2014. That's 30% more than we did the year before. And we gave away a little over 40,000, 47,000 were donated to local food banks and community outreach programs. This next slide is a program that I had the pleasure of going over to Snake River 2 weeks ago, where they dedicated a veterans unit. We had 55 gentlemen that served in all five of the military branches that are now all living together in one unit in reference to rolling out services. And it was an absolute great tribute to our military folks that somehow have made some bad choices and ended up in prison. The ceremony, a few of them ended up putting a little honor guard together to do the presentation. Cameron Smith, the Director of Veterans, wasn't able to attend that day, but he did send a representative. And when myself and Ms. Brokamp were engaging one of the gentlemen who was getting ready to leave and was uncertainty of his future, because when he was leaving, he didn't have housing to the county he was going. And the person that was representing Mr. Smith engaged in the conversation to state in that particular county down Lane they did have some housing and had other resources in reference to some medical needs. So that quick conversation, these are the things we're hoping is going to translate from this type of unit. I'd like to also state that we don't have a slide for it, but I had the ability to go over a few weeks ago where we just had over at Deer Ridge an American Legion post assigned inside the prison. It's the fourth one in the nation for correctional facilities. We have 19 military inmates right now that are belong to that post, and we're hoping to build off of that. Our last slide here, in 2014, the Department of Corrections assisted the Department of Forestry with 66 fires. We had 2,600 inmates that participated in this very long and, aggressive fire season. Besides participating in the firefighting, the mop-up, and also the camp security piece, DOC provided over 30,000 sack lunches for forestry DOC crews, as well as private contractors that are on site. Several of these inmates that learned these firefighting skills were able to and have been able to go out and get jobs with the private contractors that assist out there in the field.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Assistant Director, go back. The prison provided the meals for the firefighters?
Co-Chair Williamson and Representative Wisnett. So when they're on the firefighting scene, they have three meals a day. And they traditionally have a hot breakfast and a hot meal, because that's when folks are waking up and then they're gone. We provide the sack lunch at noontime. So when the firefighters and the camp support staff are going off into the woods, they bring their sack lunch. So at Coffee Creek and at Powder River, the staff and the adults in custody make the prepared sack lunches as prescribed by Department of Forestry, and we provide those.
Follow up, please. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the information. How much training do the people get on the fire line? Who controls them on the fire line?
Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Wisnett, that is a great question. It is a mixture of security staff that work for DOC, as well as a partnership with Department of Forestry. So at the Department of Forestry, we've had a 50-year relationship up at South Fork with them. And their crew bosses have, I think it's 13 crews that go out, not only in the firefighting participation, but also in reference to working in the forest with stream restoration, plant planning, and plant seed planting. In the firefighting units, the inmates, I think, traditionally get trained by Department of Forestry. I think it's a week long, 40 hours, depending on what they're going to be doing, if it's firefighting or if it's going to be camp support. Some of the folks not only do firefighting, but we have kitchens on site, we have showers on site. So the inmates that are in the camp, assigned to the camp, keep the camp clean and produce the meals other than the sack lunches.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair and committee members, I'll further questions since I know we're trying to get through offline, but and this is a tough issue, but I have a lot of companies, people working jobs that do actually feed firefighters and actually are contract firefighter crews. So I'll have to talk to the assistant director or the director and get some more information on how this works. But, you know, it's a tough decision. You want to use these resources if you can and want to help these people real quick. But I hate to see people I have that depend upon these jobs to feed their families and pay taxes. So I'll look into this more with the...
Happy to have that conversation.
Thank you.
Question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Besides the fire crews, I know that a lot of counties have work crews and they go out and do various things. A lot of the roadside vegetation management would not get done if it wasn't for them. Do Department of Corrections crews do any of that work as well?
Co-Chair Williamson and Representative Gorzek, yes, we do. We have several contracts with county agencies, city agencies, and states. So you'll see them on I-5. We have work crews here in Salem that do all sorts of range from picking up litter to doing all sorts of landscape maintenance.
Okay. Thank you.
That basically concludes my presentation.
Just to follow back up, can I just ask a question? Because we talk about the utilization of inmates and helping with putting out fires and some of the other works that go on, and it's been a 50-year kind of a partnership. And it's not just in Central Oregon, am I correct, that they actually get involved in some of this initiative? I need to say that because when we start talking about this, and I understand the issue that's being raised by Rep. Wisnett, but I also understand that this deployment of the inmates and those crews are more than just in one particular area, and I just need to kind of put that out there. And it's also, as I understand it, part of this when we started was not just to help with the local communities and with the fire cleanup and suppression and what have you, but it was also providing some skill sets which then can be utilized as the individual goes back into the community. One of the things that we in Oregon have done, and I'm going to put it on the record since I've been around since dirt, is that, and so has Mary, but out there in there. We had moved away from where we actually looked at true rehabilitation and making certain that individuals coming out of our institution would be going back into the community, prepared to be back in the community so that they wouldn't go back in. And we have, bit by bit over time, have taken away from the department some of the works and some of those jobs. And so now we're having to get, and also some of the education components that actually provided some of those tools with which to, so individuals could then be able to go back and become taxpayers. So I think some of the work that the department has been trying to do when we created the enterprise, quote unquote, and still at the same time not to erode the private sector, has to try to go back to be able to give meaningful skills to individuals so that they can return back to this society with some tools with which so that they can become taxpayers. Need to put that on the record because this conflict has been going on now for a lot of years.
Co-chairs and Senator Williams, I like that very well said. And just, yes, for the record, almost all our minimum prisons, except the female, we're actually engaging in conversations about getting them involved in the firefighting participation, but almost all our minimum units now, this year we got Two Rivers involved. Almost all our minimum institutions are involved in some sort of firefighting activity.
And kind of along the same line, thank you, Madam Chair, is to go back to the textiles in northeastern Oregon. I know that throughout the history of corrections in the United States, we've struggled with this issue of prison industry versus free market. And I know that we do, I believe we have like a jeans program, prison blues, things like that. How does that work when we've seen these federal prohibitions in the past about competing with
state toss?
What's that?
I think there's some state ones too, I hope. State.
Yeah. So.
Thank you, co-chairs and representative. It's a balance. There's no doubt about it. When the corrections industries was created, we were actually required to check with the community to ensure we were not displacing employees. Okay. And so that's part of the checks and balances in the systems as we try to advance and expand these programs. As the senator pointed out, we're actually required to ensure we're not displacing employees. And then it's a conversation. It's a conversation with community members. It's conversations with folks like the firefighting community, where we've talked to them a lot about how we don't want to steal jobs, but this is a felon-friendly environment. And so we've been working closely with them to ensure that they have the same, our inmates have the same firefighting training as those civilians do, so that it can be a training pool for them. It's costly to train those firefighters, so the Department of Corrections can take on that training and then hand that private industry someone ready for employment. We try to see it more as a partnership, and I know Representative will talk about this more offline, and I know that time is an issue as well, but we try to see it as a partnership and perhaps a training pool for them to advance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other
questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, now it's my pleasure to introduce Steve Robbins, who many of you know. Again, we are so fortunate to have Steve in his current role. He's been with us since 2009. Spending time in both the planning and budget office, so you know him with that hat on, as well as now in health services. He is the administrator over all of health services. Prior to joining the Department of Corrections, he actually came to us from the private sector. He spent 19 years in an executive management role overseeing North American inbound logistics with Ford Motor Company. And so you know Mr. Robbins, many of you know him through our work group on corrections healthcare that Senator Winters talked about earlier. So he is very comfortable being in this hot seat. And so with that, I turn it over to Mr. Robbins.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields and Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Robbins. I'm the Health Services Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'd first like to say how happy I am to be here on behalf of the over 500 healthcare employees that we have working for the department in sometimes very challenging and complex situations. The Department of Corrections Health Services section provides legally mandated medical, dental, mental health, and pharmacy services to the entire population of adults in custody. To accomplish this task effectively and efficiently, the department uses a managed care model, and we'll talk about some of the things that we do there as we move through the presentation. I'll go through each of the units of health services, starting with medical services, and then I'll cover some of the primary challenges for us, to include recruiting, some of the costs of medication, housing, and electronic health records as well. And then I'll conclude with some of our successes and process improvements across all of our units. We recognize the concern across the nation specific to rising healthcare costs. So some of the things we'll be talking about today have to do with how we're trying to mitigate those costs, to include the use of a third-party administrator, talking about medication formulary, and also the use of Medicaid dollars. Finally, the Department of Corrections worked closely with a work group on correctional healthcare costs created by Senate Bill 843. That was created in the 2013 session that resulted in a recently completed report for the interim committee back in December. As Senator Winters mentioned, we'll talk about some of those things as well as we go through the presentation. We'll go through these next two slides very quickly. Health services accounts for 15% of the budget for the Department of Corrections. That's both general fund and all funds. We also account for 12% of the FTE in the agency, so that's 544 FTE. Those include physicians, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, registered nurses, psychiatrists, qualified mental health professionals, pharmacists, medication technicians, and office support staff. We have 90,000 inmate contacts per month, and we prepare, package, and distribute 30,000 prescriptions per month for our DOCs in custody, and that's all accomplished by these 544 employees. Again, the major budget drivers for our agency, Mr. Gower talked about the fact that we do have to have off-site care that we provide, and we'll talk more specifically about that in a bit. There's the recruiting challenges, the cost of medication, and also the growing concern around the fact that we've got an aging population, increasingly sick, and we'll discuss that as we talk about some challenges as we move forward.
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
quick question. I want to make sure my numbers are right here. How many contacts, medical contacts per month?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, it's about 90,000, about 1 million per year.
And you have 15,000 inmates?
Correct.
14,000.
14,000 to 15,000. That's on an average about one per week for each inmate. Obviously, some using more, some using less.
Co-Chair Williams, Senator Bates, that's correct. Some of them, we might call them frequent flyers. They're folks that were receiving a considerable amount of care versus others that we see very rarely.
One last follow-up, and I'll talk to you offline. Do you find a certain percentage are the major users of the system, or is it spread evenly?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, good question. That it's a small percentage. It's the 80-20 rule, where a small percentage are using a vast majority. And especially if they're going off-site for care, that's where the costs really start to escalate.
I'll look at that with you privately. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So providing health care for our more than 14,500 inmates obviously can be a challenge. We do take pride in the level of care that we provide. We take pride in the level of care we provide. Oregon statute mandates the Department of Corrections shall provide adequate food, clothing, health, and medical care, sanitation, and security for persons confined. We are required to provide medically necessary care, which must be provided at a community standard of quality. In health services, we see all kinds of the same issues you see out in the community, from very small things to large injuries, acute illness, preventative care, chronic disease, and end-of-life care as well. For 2013 calendar year, the Department of Corrections, as I mentioned, had over 1 million medical encounters. The vast majority of those, well over 99%, occur inside the walls of our institution. It's that very small fraction that occurs outside the walls, but accounts for a very large component of our budget. We have 14 clinics across the state, one in every institution. We operate infirmary-level care in five of our institutions, and infirmary-level care means pre-op, post-op. There's monitoring, convalescence, patients requiring daily monitoring, and skilled nursing interventions. We also provide some specialty care on-site. For example, we have a dialysis unit at Two Rivers Correctional Institute in Umatilla. We currently have 18 inmates that are receiving dialysis there, and we'll looking to save nearly $2,000 per visit by opening a similar unit at Coffee Creek in Wilsonville, coming up here for the females, so we're excited about that. We bring in contractors for other specialty care services to reduce off-site visits that Mr. Gower talked about. These include dialysis, ultrasound, cardiology, mammography, OBGYN, orthopedics, and sleep studies. We continue to pursue more of those so that we can reduce those off-site transports. Off-site specialty care and hospital care are managed through the use of a third-party administrator. And that third-party administrator helps us to enhance patient care, see some cost efficiencies, as well as care coordination. And basically what that TPA does for us is it provides a discounted provider network. It gives us 20 to 30% off of billed rates. It also helps us with claims payment, comprehensive case management to reduce hospital bed stays, as well as provide us data management and reporting. When we talk about dental services specifically, we have on-site clinics at all but two of our locations, and clinics are staffed by fully licensed dentists and qualified dental assistants. Inmates who are housed at facilities without dental clinics are transported to the nearest institution for care. For this slide, the blue bars on this chart represent our total costs for just the medical unit. This does not include BHS or pharmacy. What I'd like to show you with this is the red line is our offsite costs. You can see from the 07-09 biennium through the 11-13 biennium, we were seeing significant increases in our overall costs biennium over biennium. But then you'll see as we move into this biennium, we're projected to actually be flat. And that is a monumental move for us. That is come as a direct result of our ability to use Medicaid for offsite inpatient stays. And we'll talk about that a little more detail as we move forward. According to a 2013 report published by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the cost per American per month for health care in 2013 was $771 per month. The Department of Corrections is able to do that at $562 per inmate per month. Specific to our behavioral services unit, or BHS, it provides services to mentally ill inmates in 8 institutions. The largest numbers of mentally ill are housed at Snake River out in Ontario, with the most severely mentally ill housed at Oregon State Penitentiary and at Coffee Creek in Wilsonville. DOC has seen an increased number of inmates reach our system without having been treated in the community prior to their stay with us, to the point where over the past decade, as the director mentioned, the department's become the largest mental health care provider in the state. Behavioral health provides mental health assessment and evaluation, case management, medication management, individual and group treatment, mental health risk assessments, release planning, and many other services to those folks in need in our system. We work with the adults in custody to help them understand their mental health diagnosis and offer opportunities for them to learn practical skills to help them manage their medication, their symptoms, activities of daily living, and how to interact with their providers. There are many ways to break down the types of care we provide with our behavioral health unit, but in broad terms, our care covers a continuum of housing based on acuity. Our mental health infirmaries are the highest level of mental health housing. They provide short-term psychiatric crisis stabilization, evaluation, medication adjustment for those seriously mentally ill inmates. Once it's been determined that a patient is ready, we have what are called step-down units. So they'll move from the mental health infirmary into a step-down unit, which we call our intermediate care housing. And it is there that they can continue to hopefully progress back to the general population as they move through the treatment process. We also have two kinds of mental health housing that are in general population. One is called the day treatment unit. And that's for inmates with severe and persistent mental illness and moderately high acuity. These inmates require daily to weekly contact with BHS providers. We also have mental health housing units, or MHUs, and those are designed really to more for protection for the inmates that are there, those that are from a mental health perspective are vulnerable or have developmental disabilities. Finally, in addition to the 4 tiers of mental health that we spoke about, we also have a behavioral health housing unit, which is for inmates with serious mental illness and demonstrated violent behavior.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me, maybe not right now, but the numbers of beds you have that are occupied in all 4 of these categories, especially the first 2?
Representative Williams, Senator Bates, I can give that to you right now.
Okay.
For mental health infirmary, we have 59 beds. 49 are male, 10 are female. For intermediate care housing, we have 70 beds. For day treatment units, we have 108, 72 male, 36 female. And for mental health unit, we have 552 beds, 492 are male, and 60 are female.
Follow up. Any waiting lists for any of these?
Representative Wilson, Senator Bates, not, I wouldn't say that there are no, I guess the answer would be no. I don't believe there are any waiting lists, but let me check on that, and I'll get back to you and make sure.
And last question. I don't know what kind of a pharmacy you have as far as what we call 7-Eleven drugs, psychotropic drugs. Do you have limitations on that, or step therapy you have to use, or are you able to go right into and use whatever drugs the psychiatrist thinks you should use for that patient?
Representative Williams, Senator Bates, I'm not a clinician, so okay. I won't be able to get into the details with you.
Sorry.
But we do have a formulary, a restrictive formulary. We do have processes for going outside of that formulary. And typically when folks come to us from the community, if they're on any kind of medication, our initial step is to continue them on that until they've had a chance to be assessed, and then that's reevaluated.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The Health Services Unit operates 2 pharmacy and medical supply packaging distribution centers, one in Salem and one in Ontario. And we have distributed over $27 million worth of medications this biennium to date alone. Our pharmacy operations currently prepare, package, and distribute over 30,000 per month, as I mentioned before. And all of our medication rooms are licensed and regulated both by the Board of Pharmacy and by the federal DEA. Our pharmacists do ensure compliance and work with on-site managers to make sure that our sites are up to regulations. As I mentioned before, we use a restricted medication formulary that's established and monitored by what we call a pharmacy and therapeutics committee. That's a team of pharmacists, physicians, and other healthcare professionals. And the committee meets monthly to investigate the effectiveness, cost, and security of new medications, to remove or replace medications as needed as well. And there is a peer review process, as I mentioned, for the use of off-formulary medications. We do utilize generic drugs wherever possible. If you look at our system, 94.3% of the drugs we provide are generic. We participate in Oregon's state contract with the Minnesota Multi-State Contracting Alliance for Pharmacy, or MCAP, which is a consortium of 46 states and large municipalities making large bulk pharmaceutical buys and allowing us to have the best credit terms that we can possibly get in the marketplace.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Reynolds.
And we did, because there's some discussion and some desire that we do join the state bulk purchasing. There have been several studies, a lot of discussion on the cost analysis, and the results have come back that the methodology that's being used by DOC is more cost effective. So I need to put that out there because it's come up almost every session.
Yep. Co-Chair Senator Winters, thank you.
Yep.
Very briefly, we just wanted to show with this slide the volume
every time
of medications that we're putting out there, 780,000 prescriptions written in the 11-13 biennium. It's precisely because of that kind of volume that we focus so much on our network and distribution.
Representative Wisnett.
In this committee in 2005, I asked the question about inmates being released and not having enough drug supply to get on the Oregon Health Plan. Have we solved that issue now, especially mental health medication?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, we have taken strides to solve that problem. At this point, we now are able, as early as 60 days prior to release, depending on the age of the inmate, begin applying for benefits outside. Now, we do currently provide 30 days worth of medication for inmates when they leave. And in most cases, that seems to be able to cover the process, especially since we're getting them signed up for services early enough where they can then get to see somebody within that first 30 days and continue.
Again, thank you for your reply. I have some constituents that their mental health siblings or children are not, they don't feel they got the medication in time to get, you know, there was a gap there. So I hope we'll continue to work on that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, a follow-up question.
Senator
Bates. Are they offered to see a primary care physician until mental health professionals available to them? Primary care physicians can write these prescriptions. I often find myself writing a 90-day prescription until I can get them in somewhere else. Are they aware they get assigned to a CCO, they get assigned to primary care, they can get immediately get those prescriptions covered?
Co-Chair Senator Bates, yeah, we are working with them extensively on the ways that they can process in with the institution of the coordinated care organizations. You were talking earlier about the fact that we've got multiple tiers of inmates that are leaving with various needs. We've got those folks that have acute needs, and those folks we're actually doing individual handoffs, getting them placed in specific places. It's that second tier that's the challenge right now, that we're working with them on how they can access the care, depending on the county, as quickly as possible, whether it's through a GP or not.
A follow-up. If you have trouble with this, we can fix it pretty quickly through the CCOs. They are required to give care in primary setting if it's an emergency situation. So there's no reason for these people, if they have a 30-day prescription, that they aren't having access to and getting those prescriptions filled. Maybe not counseling, maybe not getting into mental health, but they should have those prescriptions refilled without trouble. Let me know if there's a problem there.
Co-Chair Senator Bates, thank you.
We'll have a talk with the CCOs.
They'll
want to do this.
We do face a number of challenges in health services. First is recruiting. We struggle to recruit medical professionals, especially physicians and mid-level providers. It's a problem on the east side of the state, but really it's a problem for us across the state. So we're beginning to partner with the military talking to folks who are coming off of active duty to perhaps join us in the Department of Corrections. We're working aggressively with career fairs, not so much for providers, but for nursing staff. And we're also trying to increase our online presence. A recommendation coming out of the work group that Senator Winters was a part of was that we work with with OIA and the state hospital and work on solutions to perhaps collaborate in that. And we're looking forward to embarking on that here shortly. Infirmary beds on the west side. As I mentioned, we have 5 infirmaries around the state. Unfortunately, a majority of our infirmary beds are on the east side of the state. But when you look at where most of the hospitals and the specialty care are, they're on the west side of the state. So for us, that is a real challenge. Obviously, we would like to be able to grow infirmary beds on this side of the state so that we can reduce transport back and forth for inmates and provide better care. Exacerbating that problem is the fact that we have a growing number of folks in our system that have nursing home or assisted living needs. And those folks are providing quite a burden on the general population. It's very difficult to manage them in a general population setting, so they tend to be moved to the infirmary. But really, in our system, the infirmary is almost like the ER of our system, and to have them in infirmary beds really isn't the right place for them to be either. So we're talking internally about how we better position ourselves. We're talking to other states about how they're dealing with this population so that we can create specialized units to handle the challenges that these folks bring.
Madam Chair, I think we saw when we went to you and Rep. Krieger, and I know Krieger didn't go with us, Rep. Barker, that one of the things we saw with the not only the nursing home or assisted living type patients, individuals, but also hospice, that they did have on the one floor set aside for that population group. And I know that there's somebody in the audience who, like myself, have longed to have this chronologically advantaged group in a place all on one floor, and she's still going to keep talking about it, because you think that that would probably be not only a more compassionate, but it would keep, you don't have the stairs and the steps and the transport issue and some of those other issues. So just for the record, I just got to put that up there.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I totally agree. That is a part of the process that we're looking at. If we were to run a theoretical exercise around the network and look at where would be the best place to place them, that conversation is a major component of it.
Thank you. Mary smiling, too, back there behind you.
From an electronic health records perspective, we're excited about the prospect of implementing an EHR. Inmate paper medical files are cumbersome, inefficient, and it's difficult for us to query data from that. We submitted a policy option package for $3 million that was included in the governor's balance budget.
Madam Chair, I am going to literally beg you not to do this yet. Electronic medical records are maturing, and in 4 or 5 years, you should be able to get something off the shelf that will bring costs down and quality up. There is no system out there now able to do that, and I'm speaking from a state perspective of every hospital and doctor's office in the state. This has been forced on us by the federal government. It is an unmitigated disaster. Most of us are hiring scribes, cutting down our patient loads, and really become more inefficient. And the amount of record lost because of these systems is incredible. I'm going to beg you just to hold off a little bit. I believe in 4 or 5 years, as these systems mature, especially the Epic system, that there'll be a great benefit to us. But right now, you're jumping to something I'm going to tell you shouldn't do. I'm really going to just beg you not to do it, just for a little bit. These systems are maturing; they're getting better. But give us a little more time before you jump into something like this.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, if I might, you and I have had lots of conversations around this. We have committed to only engaging with a system that meets a whole host of criterion that you and I have gone over, that the healthcare work group recommended and demanded. what's in our policy option package really allows us to explore this conversation, so that timeline is going to be pushed out. And we commit to you that we will not engage with an electronic health record system that people aren't comfortable with. You will certainly be part of that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you listening to this and working with us. I did a quick cost analysis on the one for OYA they talked about earlier. If that was my system with the number of patients I have, it would cost me $560,000 a year to run that system they have in OYA in my office. I would go broke. I produce about $250,000 a year. It would cost $500,000 to run that system. It's just an inefficient system right now. So please, I beg you, just keep looking, keep talking, wait for that good system to come available, because it's coming, but it's not here yet. Thank you for your time.
The cost of new branded hepatitis C medications are receiving significant attention across the country and were a topic of many of the conversations we had with the Senate Bill 843 work group. As new hepatitis C products come to market, they're now over 90% effective with far fewer side effects. And due to the demographics of our patient population, it stands to reason that our system sees a disproportionate number of those with hepatitis C than the community at large. So that's something that's definitely a challenge for us. It's in the area of improvements that we've already seen that I'm most proud for the Department of Corrections. We talked about Medicaid before. Beginning in January of 2014, the DOC began utilizing Medicaid for claims where inmates were off-site in an inpatient status for over 24 hours. By working closely with the Oregon Health Authority, we anticipate the savings in the 2013-15 biennium to be between $11 and $9 million, and we're looking forward to that expanding as we move into the new biennium as well. I mentioned dialysis before. The fact that we are going to be instituting that at Coffee Creek should save us on average $2,000 per visit for those inmates. Again, a huge, huge savings. Assistant Director Gower talked about the Blue Room. I won't go over that again, other than to say how pleased I am from a Health Services Administration perspective that that idea came to us not from our healthcare staff, but from our custody staff. And that's really something that we're proud of, is that we've got custody staff working with health services on initiatives like that. The Department of Corrections Healthcare is accredited by the NCCHC, or the National Commission for Correctional Healthcare. And in the last biennium, all of our institutions received accreditation. We're excited about the expansion of our use of telemedicine across the state. In some of our outer locations, we're using it so that they can contact doctors here in the Salem area for clinics. We're also looking at those locations where we are struggling with some recruiting for providers to utilize telemedicine there. It's obviously not a primary resource for us, but it's a great secondary backstop for us. And last but not least, I'd just like to mention, we talked about CORE in the director's presentation. From a health services perspective, we interact quite a bit with all the processes across the agency. There is one specific process that's on the map that has to do with correctional health care. And in those areas, we're excited about beginning to actually measure things and have some evidence-based discussions as we move forward with policy. So in conclusion, the Health Services Division is proud of the care we provide. In a challenging environment, we remain focused on continuous improvement and meeting our growing needs. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
No, but I'd like to say thank you. And I want to thank you for the work, Director Peters, and the members of the work group on Senate Bill 843. And in a lot of instances, the suggestions or recommendation that came forward, you went ahead without having to do legislation to put them in action, and I just want to personally thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll start by saying I apologize for my staff and I getting mixed up with you. I said I could attend meetings any day but Monday and Friday, and so you thought I said any other day would be wrong, and Monday and Friday would be the day, so I managed to miss those meetings, or most of them. I did listen in at lunchtime, and my staff worked with you. And I read the report carefully, the work you did, and I got to tell you guys are running a good system. From a medical point of view, I have no significant offers for you at all. You're doing a great job in an efficient way, especially for the population to serve. It's pretty an impressive operation. Thank you.
Good chair, Senator Bates. Thank you.
I would offer, after our conversation with the Oregon Health Authority and with mental health and alcohol, that I think that you know, looking at what you're doing, and I know that both the senator and I are encouraging you know, more involvement and engagement with you and that agency, because if I, you know, start thinking about the numbers that you gave us today on your mental health services and your mental health need inside of the prison system, as I call them, your cities, your 14 cities, that I think that we would be remiss as policymakers if we did not recognize these nexuses and that resource value. So, you know, I'm continuing to encourage that conversation, and I know that this good senator and others will also begin working with them as well on policies that we can help strengthen what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Co-chairs, I now would like to introduce Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division, and she has been in that role now for
two and a half weeks.
And I feel so confident in her abilities that even though she only has 2 weeks behind her, she sits in this chair before you today. Many of you recognize Ms. Stewart. She was previously the superintendent at Coffee Creek. She also was the administrator of our Government Efficiencies and Communications Office, so was in this building often for quite some time. She has been with the department for 19 years, so she's a nearly 20-year expert of the Oregon Department of Corrections and has spent many years in the area of transitional services. So now leading the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with all of that expertise, I must say we are very fortunate to have her in that role. So with that, I will pass it off to you, and you can
Thank
at least get
you.
Started with your
Thank
presentation.
Thank you, yes. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Williamson and Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I am the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And in an effort to keep us on track with time, I am going to fly through a few of these slides. I will not finish today, but we'll get through as much as possible. This slide up here is just the units within the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division. I have to say that I am so proud and honored to be part of this division and look forward to working with these professionals over hopefully the next many years. I'll spend some time getting into explaining these units in more detail. This slide shows that the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division is 4.8% of the agency's total fund budget and 4.3% of the agency's general fund budget. In this slide, we're looking at OMR FTE in comparison to the rest of the agency. The majority of these individuals work in our Offender Information and Sentence Computation Unit and Religious Services. And while we just make up 4.3% of the agency's total FTE, we do coordinate 2,400 volunteers and 180 contractors across the state who provide invaluable services to the Department of Corrections. This slide illustrates several areas where the division is challenged to adequately fund and implement new services, supports, and initiatives. The three listed up here are mandated. The top three are mandated. And the department has several efforts aimed at helping our population obtain valid ID. We do valid with previous photo process and DMV trips. Costs associated with work are currently managed within existing resources. However, we have been working very closely with the Department of Motor Vehicles. We're improving our processes, streamlining our systems, which means we'll be able to serve more offenders, which also means that the costs will increase. And we estimate that we will be spending at the end of this biennium approximately $138,000 in these two areas. The department is responsible for fees associated with ordering birth certificates. The cost of the department is running approximately $115,000 per biennium. GED costs have also gone up now that we have moved to a computer-based testing system, and that's costing an additional $146,000. In 2013, legislation passed directing the department to conduct risk assessments of persons convicted of certain sex offenses. This is to determine the levels of notification for state police and to LEDs. There is a bill this session that would move this responsibility from the Department of Corrections to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. However, if this bill does not pass, it means an additional $350,000 per biennium to the Department of Corrections. While not a mandated service, the Victim Information and Notification Every Day system, also known as our VINE system, is a critical notification system for victims of crime. VINE provides victims with notification of offender releases, offender deaths, escapes, and this program was originally funded by a grant. However, that funding is no longer there. We fund this internally, but the funding is not sustainable. The current revenue through the Department of Justice and Oregon Corrections Enterprises is $643,000, and the cost to run the program is $738,000. We do take our public safety obligation to victims very seriously, and certainly we'll continue our systems that we have in place to ensure victims get what they need. How are we doing on time? Okay.
6 minutes.
Intake and assessment. Our philosophy is that transition begins the minute an individual enters into our system, whether they're serving a sentence for 2 years or 20 years. Everything we do is to prepare those in our custody for the handoff to community corrections and to prepare a successful reentry back into the community. The primary function of the intake unit is to accurately assess and identify each individual's risk and needs factors and to establish an individualized case plan. This case plan is designed to serve as a foundation in identifying effective interventions and serve as the individual's roadmap throughout their incarceration and transition back into the community. To gauge our work in this area, we have a measure on our agency scorecard that tracks the percent of all inmates who leave intake with a completed case plan. Our offender information and sentence computation unit is a very complex part of our organization. The sentencing laws that have passed are complex and they're intertwined. These staff must understand these complex sentencing laws. They must interpret sentence judgments, and they must apply earned time credit all to come up with a calculated prison sentence. This unit continually mitigates risk through well-designed systems and processes. Our Office of Population Management centrally manages the movement of the inmates to guide their placement to the right bed for the right intervention. They manage those sentenced to the Department of Corrections for those within the state, out of state, in OIA custody, and other jurisdictions. The unit uses a multidisciplinary approach to identify appropriate institution placement. They take into consideration treatment, mental health, developmental disability, work, education, special population management. And as you can imagine, this is no easy task since the department is operating with emergency beds. We know education can play an especially important role upon reentry. Research shows that individuals who participate in correctional education programs have lower rates of rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration. In fact, there's a 2013 meta-analysis published by the RAND Corporation that found, on average, inmates who participate in correctional education programs have a 43% lower odds of recidivating than those who do not. This translates to a reduction in the risk of recidivating by 13 percentage points. Through interagency agreements and strong collaborations with various community colleges, we provide adult basic skills development, which includes adult basic education, English as a second language, GED, and special education. While we do not spend general dollars to get individuals advanced degrees, our community college partners do provide college classes through grants, through private donors, and through self-pay by our adults in custody. And I think this will be our last slide of the day. We also offer a number of vocational programs that help inmates develop specific skills that will assist them in obtaining employment following release. All of these programs include training and production components that provide product or service to generate revenue to reduce the costs of the programs. The Education and Training Unit also oversees apprenticeship programs, which involve a partnership between the Department, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Columbia Gorge Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. The meta-analysis that I mentioned earlier, conducted by the RAND Corporation, showed that odds of obtaining employment post-release among adults in custody who participated in correctional education, either academic or vocational programs, were 13% higher than the odds of those who did not. More specifically, those individuals who participated in vocational training programs were 28% more likely to obtain employment after release from prison than those who did not. And I think we will end here. And if you have any questions.
Senator Bates.
Why is the guy in the picture looking up and not looking down?
Camera.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator, he's so skilled that he could pause. Okay.
Not really.
He's so well trained, he could pause.
He could handle it, okay.
Any other questions? If not, we will close the public hearing on House Bill, I'm sorry, on Senate Bill 5504, and we will meet back here tomorrow and continue the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Very good. We're off.
Yes.
We have two.
Yes.
We have two.